This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio present The Order, a novel by Daniel Silva, performed by George Goodell.
As always, for my wife, Jamie, and my children, Lily and Nicholas. When Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves." And all the people answered, "His blood shall be on us and our children." Matthew chapter 27, verses 24 and 25. Every misfortune that subsequently befell the Jews, from the destruction of Jerusalem to Auschwitz, carried an echo of that invented blood pact from the trial. Anne Rowe, Pontius Pilate. You have to be willingly ignorant of the past not to know where all this leads. Paul Krugman, The New York Times.
Foreword. His Holiness Pope Paul VII was introduced in The Confessor, the third book of the Gabrielon series. Subsequently, he appeared in The Messenger and The Fallen Angel. Born Pietro Lucchese, he is the former Patriarch of Venice and the direct successor of Pope John Paul II. In my fictitious version of the Vatican, the papacies of Joseph Ratzinger and Jorge Mario Bergoglio, the Supreme Pontiffs Benedict XVI and Francis did not occur.
Part 1. Interregnum. Chapter 1. Rome. The call arrived at 11:42 p.m. Luigi Donati hesitated before answering. The number displayed on the screen of his telefonino belonged to Albanese. There was only one reason why he would ring at such an hour. "Where are you, Excellency?" "Outside the walls."
"Ah, yes, it's a Thursday, isn't it?"
"Is there a problem?"
"Better not to say too much on the phone. One never knows who might be listening."
The night into which Donati stepped was damp and cold. He was dressed in a black clerical suit and Roman collar, not the fuchsia-trimmed cassock and simar he wore around the office, which was how men of his ecclesiastical rank referred to the apostolic palace. An archbishop, Donati served as private secretary to His Holiness Pope Paul VII. Tall and lean, with rich dark hair and movie-idol features, he had recently celebrated his 63rd birthday. Age had done nothing to diminish his good looks. Vanity Fair magazine had recently christened him Luscious Luigi. The article had caused him no end of embarrassment inside the backbiting world of the Curia. Still, given Donati's well-deserved reputation for ruthlessness, no one had dared to mention it to his face. No one but the Holy Father, who had teased him mercilessly. "Better not to say too much on the phone." Donati had been preparing himself for this moment. For a year or more, ever since the first mild heart attack, which he had concealed from the rest of the world, and even much of the Curia. But why tonight, of all nights? The street was oddly quiet. Deathly quiet, thought Donati suddenly. It was a palazzo-lined avenue just off the Via Veneto, the sort of place a priest rarely set foot, especially a priest educated and trained by the Society of Jesus, the intellectually rigorous and sometimes rebellious order to which Donati belonged. His official Vatican car, with its SCV license plates, waited curbside. The driver was from the Corpo della Gendarmeria, the Vatican's 130-member police force. He headed westward across Rome at an unhurried pace. "He doesn't know." On his mobile phone, Donati scanned the websites of the leading Italian newspapers. They were in the dark. So were their colleagues in London and New York. "Turn on the radio, Johnny."
"Music, Excellency."
"News, please." It was more drivel from Saviano, another rant about how Arab and African immigrants were destroying the country, as if the Italians weren't more than capable of making a fine mess of things themselves. Saviano had been badgering the Vatican for months about a private audience with the Holy Father. Donati, with no small amount of pleasure, had refused to grant it. "That's quite enough, Johnny." The radio went blessedly silent. Donati peered out the window of the luxury German-made sedan. It was no way for a soldier of Christ to travel. He supposed this would be his final journey across Rome by chauffeured limousine. For nearly two decades, he had served as something like the chief of staff of the Roman Catholic Church. It had been a tumultuous time. A terrorist attack on St. Peter's, a scandal involving antiquities and the Vatican museums, the scourge of priestly sexual abuse, and yet Donati had relished every minute of it. Now, in the blink of an eye, it was over. He was once again a mere priest. He had never felt more alone. The car crossed the Tiber and turned onto the Via della Conciliazione, the broad boulevard Mussolini had carved through Rome's slums. The floodlit dome of the Basilica, restored to its original glory, loomed in the distance. They followed the curve of Bernini's colonnade to St. Anne's Gate, where a Swiss guard waved them onto the territory of the city-state. He was dressed in his night uniform, a blue tunic with a white schoolboy collar, knee-length socks, a black beret, a cape against the evening chill. His eyes were dry, his face untroubled. He doesn't know. The car moved slowly up the Via Sant'Anna, past the barracks of the Swiss Guard, the Church of St. Anne, the Vatican printing offices, and the Vatican Bank, before coming to a stop next to an archway leading to the San Damaso courtyard. Donati crossed the cobbles on foot, boarded the most important lift in all of Christendom, and ascended to the third floor of the Apostolic Palace. He hurried along the loggia, a wall of glass on one side, a fresco on the other. A left turn brought him to the papal apartments. Another Swiss guard, this one in full dress uniform, stood straight as a ramrod outside the door. Donati walked past him without a word and went inside. Thursday, he was thinking. Why did it have to be a Thursday? 18 years, thought Donati, as he surveyed the Holy Father's private study, and nothing had changed. Only the telephone. Donati had finally managed to convince the Holy Father to replace Wojtyła's ancient rotary contraption with a modern multiline device. Otherwise, the room was exactly the way the Pole had left it. The same austere wooden desk, the same beige chair, the same worn oriental rug, the same golden clock and crucifix. Even the blotter and pen set had belonged to Wojtyła the Great. For all the early promise of his papacy, the promise of a kinder, less repressive church, Pietro Lucchesi had never fully escaped the long shadow of its predecessor. Donati, by some instinct, marked the time on his wristwatch. It was 12:07 a.m. The Holy Father had retired to the study that evening at 8:30 for 90 minutes of reading and writing. Ordinarily, Donati remained at his master's side or just down the hall in his office. But because it was a Thursday, the one night of the week he had to himself, he had stayed only until 9:00. "Do me a favor before you leave, Luigi." Lucchesi had asked Donati to open the heavy curtains covering the study's window. It was the same window from which the Holy Father prayed the Angelus each Sunday at noon. Donati had complied with his master's wishes. He had even opened the shutters so His Holiness could gaze upon St. Peter's Square while he slaved over his curial paperwork. Now, the curtains were tightly drawn. Donati moved them aside. The shutters were closed, too. The desk was tidy, not Lucchesi's usual clutter. There was a cup of tea, half empty, a spoon resting on the saucer that had not been there when Donati departed. Several documents in manila folders were stacked neatly beneath the old retractable lamp. A report from the Archdiocese of Philadelphia regarding the financial fallout of the abuse scandal. Remarks for next Wednesday's general audience. The first draft of a homily for a forthcoming papal visit to Brazil. Notes for an encyclical on the subject of immigration that was sure to rile Saviano and his fellow travelers in the Italian far right. One item, however, was missing. "You'll see that he gets it, won't you, Luigi?" Donati checked the wastebasket. It was empty. Not so much as a scrap of paper. "Looking for something, Excellency?" Donati glanced up and saw Cardinal Domenico Albanese eyeing him from the doorway. Albanese was a Calabrian by birth and by profession, a creature of the Curia. He held several senior positions in the Holy See, including president of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue and archivist and librarian of the Holy Roman Church. None of that, however, explained his presence in the papal apartments at 7 minutes past midnight. Domenico Albanese was the Camerlengo. It was his responsibility alone to issue the formal declaration that the throne of St. Peter was vacant. "Where is he?" asked Donati.
"In the kingdom of heaven," intoned the cardinal.
"And the body?" Had Albanese not heard the sacred calling, he might have moved slabs of marble for his living, or hurled carcasses in a Calabrian abattoir. Donati followed him along a brief corridor into the bedroom. Three more cardinals waited in the half-light: Marcel Gobert, José María Navarro, and Angelo Francona. Gobert was the Secretary of State, effectively the Prime Minister and Chief Diplomat of the world's smallest country. Navarro was Prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, guardian of Catholic orthodoxy, defender against heresy. Francona, the oldest of the three, was the Dean of the College of Cardinals. As such, he would preside over the next conclave. It was Navarro, a Spaniard of noble stock, who addressed Donati first. Though he had lived and worked in Rome for nearly a quarter century, he still spoke Italian with a pronounced Castilian accent.
"Luigi, I know how painful this must be for you. We were his faithful servants, but you were the one he loved the most."
Cardinal Gobert, a thin Parisian with a feline face, nodded profoundly at the Spaniard's curial bromide, as did the three laymen standing in the shadow at the edge of the room: Dr. Octavio Gallo, the Holy Father's personal physician, Lorenzo Vitale, chief of the Corpo della Gendarmeria, and Colonel Alois Metzler, commandant of the Pontifical Swiss Guard. Donati, it seemed, was the last to arrive. It was he, the private secretary, who should have summoned the senior princes of the church to the bedside of the dead pope, not the Camerlengo. Suddenly, he was racked by guilt. But when Donati looked down at the figure stretched upon the bed, his guilt gave way to overwhelming grief. Lucchese was still wearing his white soutane, though his slippers had been removed, and his giacchetto was nowhere to be seen. Someone had placed the hands upon the chest. They were clutching his rosary. The eyes were closed, the jaw slack, but there was no evidence of pain on his face, nothing to suggest he had suffered. Indeed, Donati would not have been surprised if His Holiness woke suddenly and inquired about his evening. He was still wearing his white soutane. Donati had been the keeper of the Holy Father's schedule from the first day of his pontificate. The evening routine rarely varied: dinner from 7 to 8:30, paperwork in the study from 8:30 until 10, followed by 15 minutes of prayer and reflection in his private chapel. Typically, he was in bed by 10:30, usually with an English detective novel, his guilty pleasure. Devices and Desires by P.D. James lay on the bedside table beneath his reading glasses. Donati opened it to the page marked. 45 minutes later, Ricards was back at the scene of the murder. Donati closed the book. The Supreme Pontiff, he reckoned, had been dead for nearly 2 hours, perhaps longer. Calmly, he asked, "Who found him? Not one of the household nuns, I hope?"
"It was me," replied Cardinal Albanese.
"Where was he?"
"His Holiness departed this life from the chapel. I discovered him a few minutes after 10. As for the exact time of his passing..."
The Calabrian shrugged his heavy shoulders.
"I cannot say, Excellency."
"Why wasn't I contacted immediately?"
"I searched for you, everywhere."
"You should have called my mobile."
"I did. Several times, in fact. There was no answer."
The Camerlengo, thought Donati, was being untruthful. "And what were you doing in the chapel, Eminence?"
"This is beginning to sound like an inquisition."
Albanese's eyes moved briefly to Cardinal Navarro before settling once more on Donati.
"His Holiness asked me to pray with him. I accepted his invitation."
"He phoned you directly?"
"In my apartment," said the Camerlengo with a nod.
"At what time?" Albanese lifted his eyes to the ceiling as though trying to recall a minor detail that had slipped his mind.
9:15, perhaps 9:20. He asked me to come a few minutes after 10. When I arrived...
Donati looked down at the man stretched lifeless upon the bed.
And how did he get here? I carried him.
Alone?
His Holiness bore the weight of the church on his shoulders, said Albanese. But in death he was light as a feather. Because I could not reach you, I summoned the Secretary of State, who in turn rang Cardinals Navarro and Francona. I then called Dottore Gallo, who made the pronouncement. Death by a massive heart attack. His second, was it not, or was it his third?
Donati looked at the papal physician. At what time did you make the declaration, Dottore Gallo?
11:10, Excellency.
Colonel Albanese cleared his throat gently.
I've made a slight adjustment to the timeline in my official statement. If it is your wish, Luigi, I can say that you were the one who found him.
That won't be necessary. Donati dropped to his knees next to the bed. In life, the Holy Father had been elfin. Death had diminished him further. Donati remembered the day the conclave unexpectedly chose Lucchese, the Patriarch of Venice, to be the 265th Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. In the Room of Tears, he had chosen the smallest of the three ready-made cassocks. Even so, he had seemed like a small boy wearing his father's shirt. As he stepped onto the balcony of St. Peter's, his head was barely visible above the balustrade. The Vaticanisti christened him Pietro the Improbable. Church hardliners had referred to him derisively as Pope Accidental. After a moment, Donati felt a hand on his shoulder. It was like lead. Therefore, it had to be Albanese's.
The ring, Excellency.
It was once the responsibility of the Camerlengo to destroy the dead pope's ring of the fisherman in the presence of the College of Cardinals. But like the three taps to the papal forehead with a silver hammer, the practice had been done away with. Lucchese's ring, which he seldom wore, would merely be scored with two deep cuts in the sign of the cross. Other traditions, however, remained in place, such as the immediate locking and sealing of the papal apartments. Even Donati, Lucchese's only private secretary, would be barred from entering once the body was removed. Still on his knees, Donati opened the drawer of the bedside table and grasped the heavy golden ring. He surrendered it to Cardinal Albanese, who placed it in a velvet pouch. Solemnly, he declared, "Sede vacante." The throne of St. Peter was now empty. The Apostolic Constitution dictated that Cardinal Albanese would serve as temporary caretaker of the Roman Catholic Church during the interregnum, which ended with the election of a new pope. Donati, a mere titular archbishop, would have no say in the matter. In fact, now that his master was gone, he was without portfolio or power, answerable only to the Camerlengo. "When do you intend to release the statement?" asked Donati.
"I was waiting for you to arrive."
"Might I review it?"
"Time is of the essence. If we delay any longer—"
"Of course, Eminence." Donati placed his hand atop Lucchese's. It was already cold. "I'd like to have a moment alone with him."
"A moment," said the Camerlengo.
The room slowly emptied. Cardinal Albanese was the last to leave. "Tell me something, Domenico." The Camerlengo paused in the doorway.
"Excellency?"
"Who closed the curtains in the study?"
"The curtains?"
"They were open when I left at 9. The shutters, too."
"I closed them, Excellency.
I didn't want anyone in the square to see lights burning in the apartments so late." "Yes, of course. That was wise of you, Domenico." The Camerlengo went out, leaving the door open. Alone with his master, Donati fought back tears. There would be time for grieving later. He leaned close to Lucchese's ear and gently squeezed the cold hand.
"Speak to me, old friend," he whispered.
"Tell me what really happened here tonight." Chapter 2. Jerusalem, Venice. It was Chiara who secretly informed the Prime Minister that her husband was in desperate need of a holiday. Since reluctantly settling into the executive suite of King Saul Boulevard, he had scarcely granted himself even an afternoon off, only a few days of working convalescence after the bombing in Paris that had fractured two vertebrae in his lower back. Still, it was not something to be undertaken lightly. Gabriel required secure communications and, more important, heavy security. So too did Chiara and the twins. Irene and Raphael would soon celebrate their fourth birthday. The threat against the Alon family was so immense, they had never once set foot outside the state of Israel. But where would they go? Exotic travel to a distant destination was not an option. They would have to remain reasonably close to Israel so Gabriel, in the all-too-likely event of a national emergency, could be back at King Saul Boulevard in a matter of hours. There was no South African safari in their future. No trip to Australia or the Galapagos. It was probably for the best. Gabriel had a troubled relationship with wild animals. Besides, the last thing Chiara wanted was to exhaust him with yet another long flight. Now that he was the director general of the office, he was constantly shuttling to Washington to consult with his American partners at Langley. What he needed most was rest. Then again, recreation did not come naturally to him. He was a man of enormous talent, but few hobbies. He did not ski or snorkel, and he had never once wielded a golf club or a tennis racket, except as a weapon. Beaches bored him unless they were cold and windblown. He enjoyed sailing, especially in the challenging waters off the west of England, or strapping a rucksack to his back and pounding across a barren moorland. Even Chiara, a retired office field operative, was incapable of matching his breakneck pace for more than a mile or two. The children would surely wilt. The trick would be to find something for Gabriel to do while they were on holiday, a small project that might occupy him for a few hours each morning until the children were awake and dressed and ready to begin their day. And what if this project could be carried out in a city where he was already comfortable? The city where he had studied the craft of art restoration and served his apprenticeship. The city where he and Chiara had met and fallen in love. She was a native of this city, and her father served as chief rabbi to its dwindling community of Jews. Furthermore, her mother had been pestering her about bringing the children for a visit. It would be perfect, she thought. The proverbial two birds with one stone. But when? August was out of the question. It was far too hot and humid, and the city would be submerged beneath a sea of packaged tourists, the selfie-snapping hordes who followed snarling guides around the city for an hour or two before gulping down an overpriced cappuccino at Café Florian and returning to their cruise ships. But if they waited until, say, November, the weather would be cool and clear, and they would have the sestiere largely to themselves. It would give them a chance to ponder their future without the distraction of the office or daily life in Israel. Gabriel had informed the Prime Minister that he would serve only a single term. It was not too early to begin thinking about how they were going to spend the rest of their lives and where they were going to raise their children. Neither of them was getting any younger. Gabriel especially. She did not inform him of her plans, as it would only invite a lengthy oration concerning all the reasons why the state of Israel would collapse if he took so much as a single day off from work. Instead, she conspired with Uzi Navot, the deputy director, to select the dates. Housekeeping, the office division that acquired and managed safe properties, saw to the accommodations. The local police and intelligence services, with whom Gabriel was very close, agreed to handle the security. All that remained was the project to keep Gabriel busy. In late October, Chiara rang Francesco Tiepolo, owner of the region's most prominent restoration firm. "I have just the thing. I'll email a photo." 3 weeks later, after a particularly contentious meeting of Israel's fractious cabinet, Gabriel returned home to find the Alon family's bags packed. "You're leaving me?"
"No," said Chiara. "We're going on vacation. All of us."
"I can't possibly. It's taken care of, darling."
"Does Uzi know?"
Chiara nodded.
"And so does the Prime Minister."
"Where are we going? And for how long?"
She answered. "What will I do with myself for 2 weeks?"
Chiara handed him the photograph.
"There's no way I can possibly finish it."
"You'll do as much as you can."
"And let someone else touch my work?"
"It won't be the end of the world."
"You never know, Chiara. It just might be." The apartment occupied the piano nobile of a crumbling old palazzo in Canareggio, the northernmost of Venice's six traditional sestieri. It had a grand salon, a large kitchen filled with modern appliances, and a terrace overlooking the Rio della Misericordia. In one of the four bedrooms, housekeeping had established a secure link to King Saul Boulevard, complete with a tent-like structure, in the jargon of the office it was known as a chuppah, that allowed Gabriel to speak on the phone without fear of electronic eavesdropping. Carabinieri, officers in plain clothes, kept watch outside on the Fondamenta dei Ormesini. With their consent, Gabriel carried a 9mm Beretta pistol. So did Chiara, who was a much better shot than he. A few paces along the embankment was an iron bridge, the only one in Venice, and on the opposite side of the canal was a broad square called the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo. There was a museum, a bookstore, and the offices of the Jewish community. The Casa Israelitica di Riposo, a rest home for the elderly, occupied the northern flank. Next to it was a stark bas-relief memorial to the Jews of Venice who, in December 1943, were rounded up, interned in concentration camps, and later murdered at Auschwitz. Two heavily armed carabinieri kept watch over the memorial from a fortified kiosk. Of the 250,000 people who still made the sinking islands of Venice their home, only the Jews required round-the-clock police protection. The apartment buildings lining the Campo were the tallest in Venice, for in the Middle Ages their occupants had been forbidden by the church to reside anywhere else in the city. On the uppermost floors of several of the buildings were small synagogues, now meticulously restored, that had once served the communities of Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews who dwelled beneath. The ghetto's two functioning synagogues were located just to the south of the Campo. Both were clandestine. There was nothing in their outward appearance to suggest they were Jewish houses of worship. The Spanish synagogue had been founded by Chiara's ancestors in 1580. Unheeded, it was open for Passover to the high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The Levantine synagogue, located across a tiny square, served the community in winter. Rabbi Jacob Zolli and his wife, Alicia, lived around the corner from the Levantine synagogue in a narrow little house overlooking a secluded corte. The Alon family dined there on Monday evening, a few hours after their arrival in Venice. Gabriel managed to check his phone only four times. "I hope there isn't a problem," said Rabbi Zolli. "The usual," murmured Gabriel. "I'm relieved." "Don't be." The rabbi laughed quietly. His gaze moved approvingly around the table, settling briefly on his two grandchildren, his wife, and finally, his daughter. Candlelight shone in her eyes. They were the color of caramel and flecked with gold. "Chiara has never looked more radiant. You've obviously made her very happy." "Have I really?" "There were definitely bumps along the road," the rabbi's tone was admonitory, "but I assure you she thinks she's the luckiest person in the world." "I'm afraid that honor belongs to me." "Rumor has it she deceived you about your travel plans." Gabriel frowned. "Surely there's a prohibition against that sort of thing in the Torah?" "I can't think of one." "It was probably for the best," admitted Gabriel. "I doubt I would have agreed otherwise." "I'm pleased you are finally able to bring the children to Venice. But I'm afraid you've come at a difficult time." Rabbi Zolli lowered his voice. "Saviano and his friends on the far right have awakened dark forces in Europe." Giuseppe Saviano was Italy's new prime minister. He was xenophobic, intolerant, distrustful of the free press, and had little patience for niceties such as parliamentary democracy or the rule of law. Neither did his close friend Jörg Kaufmann, the fledgling neo-fascist who now served as Chancellor of Austria. In France, it was widely assumed that Cécile Leclerc, leader of the Popular Front, would be the next occupant of the Élysée Palace. Germany's National Democrats, led by a former neo-Nazi skinhead named Axel Brunner, were expected to finish second in January's general election. Everywhere, it seemed, the extreme right was ascendant. Its rise in Western Europe had been fueled by globalization, economic uncertainty, and the continent's rapidly changing demographics. Muslims now accounted for 5% of Europe's population. A growing number of native Europeans regarded Islam as an existential threat to their religious and cultural identity. Their anger and resentment, once restrained or hidden from public view, now coursed through the veins of the internet like a virus. Attacks on Muslims had risen sharply. So too had physical assaults and acts of vandalism directed against Jews. Indeed, anti-Semitism in Europe had reached a level not seen since World War II. "Our cemetery on the Lido was vandalized again last week," said Rabbi Zolli. "Gravestones overturned, swastikas, the usual. My congregants are frightened. I tried to comfort them. But I'm frightened too. Anti-immigrant politicians like Saviano have shaken the bottle and removed the cork. Their adherents complain about the refugees from the Middle East and Africa, but we are the ones they despise the most. It is the longest hatred. Here in Italy, it is no longer frowned upon to be an anti-Semite. One can wear one's contempt for us quite openly now. And the results have been entirely predictable." "The storm will pass," said Gabriel with little conviction. "Your grandparents probably said the same thing. So did the Jews of Venice. Your mother managed to walk out of Auschwitz alive. The Jews of Venice weren't so fortunate." Rabbi Zolli shook his head. "I've seen this movie before, Gabriel. I know how it ends. Never forget, the unimaginable can happen. But let's not spoil the evening with unpleasant talk. I want to enjoy the company of my grandchildren." Next morning, Gabriel woke early and spent a few hours beneath the shelter of the chuppah talking to his senior staff at Kingshall Boulevard. Afterward, he hired a motorboat and took Chiara and the children on a tour of the city and the Lagoon Islands. It was far too cold to swim on the Lido, but the children removed their shoes and chased gulls and terns along the beach. On the way back to Cannaregio, they stopped at the Church of San Sebastiano in Dorsoduro to see Veronese's Virgin and Child in Glory with the Saints, which Gabriel had restored during Chiara's pregnancy. Later, as the autumn light faded in the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo, the children joined in a noisy game of tag, while Gabriel and Chiara looked on from a wooden bench outside the Casa Israelitica di Riposo. "This might be my favorite bench in the world," said Chiara. "It's where you were sitting the day you came to your senses and begged me to take you back. Do you remember, Gabriel? It was after the attack on the Vatican." "I'm not sure which was worse, the rocket-propelled grenades and the suicide bombers, or the way you treated me."
"You deserved it, you dolt. I should have never agreed to see you again."
"And now, our children are playing in the Campo," said Gabriel. Chiara glanced at the Carabinieri post.
"Watched over by men with guns."
The next day, Wednesday, Gabriel slipped from the apartment after his morning phone calls and, with a varnished wooden case beneath his arm, walked to the church of the Madonna dell'Orto. The nave was in semi-darkness and scaffolding concealed the double-framed pointed arches of the side aisles. The church had no transept, but in the rear was a five-sided apse that contained the grave of Jacopo Robusti, better known as Tintoretto. It was there that Gabriel found Francesco Tiepolo. He was an enormous bear-like man with a tangled gray and black beard. As usual, he was dressed in a flowing white tunic with a scarf knotted rakishly around his neck. He embraced Gabriel tightly.
"I always knew you would come back."
"I'm on holiday, Francesco. Let's not get carried away." Tiepolo waved his hand as though he were trying to scare away the pigeons in the Piazza di San Marco.
"Today you're on holiday, but one day you'll die in Venice."
He looked down at the grave.
"I suppose we'll have to bury you somewhere other than a church, won't we?"
Tintoretto produced 10 paintings for the church between 1552 and 1569, including Presentation of the Virgin Mary in the Temple, which hung on the right side of the nave. A massive canvas measuring 480 by 429 centimeters, it was among his masterworks. The first phase of the restoration, the removal of the discolored varnish, had been completed. All that remained was the inpainting, the retouching of those portions of the canvas lost to time and stress. It would be a monumental task. Gabriel reckoned it would take a single restorer a year, if not longer. What poor soul removed the varnish? Antonio Politi, I hope?
It was Paulina, the new girl. She was hoping to observe you while you worked. I assume you disabused her of that notion.
In no uncertain terms, she said you could have any part of the painting you wanted except for the Virgin.
Gabriel lifted his gaze toward the upper reaches of the towering canvas. Miriam, the 3-year-old daughter of Joachim and Anne, Jews from Nazareth, was hesitantly climbing the 15 steps of the Temple of Jerusalem toward the high priest. A few steps below reclined a woman robed in brown silk. She was holding a young child, a boy or girl, it was impossible to tell.
Her, said Gabriel, and the child.
Are you sure? They need a great deal of work.
Gabriel smiled sadly, his eyes on the canvas.
It's the least I can do for them.
He remained in the church until 2 o'clock, longer than he had intended. That evening, he and Chiara left the children with the grandparents and dined alone in a restaurant on the other side of the Grand Canal in San Polo. The next day, Thursday, he took the children on a gondola ride in the morning and worked on the Tintoretto from midday until 5, when Tiepolo locked the church's doors for the night. Chiara decided to prepare dinner at the apartment. Afterward, Gabriel supervised the nightly running battle known as bath time before retreating to the shelter of the chuppah to deal with a minor crisis at home. It was nearly 1 by the time he crawled into bed. Chiara was reading a novel, oblivious to the television, which was muted. On the screen was a live shot of St. Peter's Basilica. Gabriel raised the volume and learned that an old friend had died. Chapter 3. Canareggio, Venice. Later that morning, the body of His Holiness Pope Paul VII was moved to the Sala Clementina on the 2nd floor of the Apostolic Palace. It remained there until early the following afternoon, when it was transferred in solemn procession to St. Peter's Basilica for 2 days of public viewing. 4 Swiss guards stood watch around the dead pontiff, halberds at the ready. The Vatican press corps made much of the fact that Archbishop Luigi Donati, the Holy Father's closest aide and confidant, rarely left his master's side. Church tradition dictated that the funeral and burial of the Pope occur 4 to 6 days after his death. Cardinal Camerlengo Domenico Albanese announced that it would take place the following Tuesday and that the conclave would convene 10 days after that. The Vaticanisti were predicting a hard-fought and divisive contest between reformers and conservatives. The smart money was on Cardinal José María Navarro, who had used his position as a church's doctrinal gatekeeper to build a power base within the College of Cardinals that rivaled even the dead popes. In Venice, where Pietro Lucchesi had reigned as patriarch, the mayor declared 3 days of mourning. The bells of the city were silent, and a moderately attended prayer service was held in St. Mark's Basilica. Otherwise, life went on as normal. A minor acqua alta flooded a portion of Santa Croce, a colossal cruise ship plowed into the wharf on the Giudecca Canal. In the bars where locals gathered for coffee or a glass of brandy against the autumn chill, one rarely heard the dead pontiff's name. Cynical by nature, few Venetians bothered to attend Mass on a regular basis, and fewer still lived their lives in accordance with the teachings of the men from the Vatican. The churches of Venice, the most beautiful in all of Christendom, were places where foreign tourists went to gawk at Renaissance art. Gabriel, however, followed the events in Rome with more than a passing interest. On the morning of the Pope's funeral, he arrived at the church early and worked without interruption until 12:15, when he heard the hollow echo of footfalls in the nave. He raised his magnifying visor and cautiously parted the tarpaulin shroud that covered his platform. General Cesare Ferrari, commander of the Carabinieri's Division for the Defense of Cultural Patrimony, better known as the Art Squad, returned his gaze without expression. Uninvited, the general stepped behind the shroud and contemplated the enormous canvas which was awash in the searing white light of 2 halogen lamps.
One of his better ones, don't you think?
He was under enormous pressure to prove himself. Veronese had been publicly recognized as the successor of Titian and the finest painter in Venice. Poor Tintoretto was no longer receiving the sort of commissions he once did.
This was his parish church.
You don't say. He lived around the corner on the Fondamenta di Mori. The general swept aside the tarpaulin and went into the nave. There used to be a Bellini in this church,
Madonna with Child. It was stolen in 1993. The art squad has been looking for it ever since.
He peered at Gabriel over his shoulder.
You haven't seen it, have you?
Gabriel smiled. Shortly before becoming chief of the office, he had recovered the most sought-after stolen painting in the world, Caravaggio's Nativity with St. Francis and St. Lawrence. He had made certain that the art squad received all the credit. It was for that reason, among others, that General Ferrari had agreed to provide round-the-clock security for Gabriel and his family during their Venetian holiday.
You're supposed to be relaxing, said the general.
Gabriel lowered his magnifying visor.
I am.
Any problems?
For inexplicable reasons, I'm having a bit of trouble recreating the color of this woman's garment.
I was referring to your security.
It seems my return to Venice has gone unnoticed.
Not entirely.
The general glanced at his wristwatch.
I don't suppose I could convince you to take a break for lunch.
I never eat lunch when I'm working.
Yes, I know.
The general switched off the halogen lamps.
I remember.
Tiepolo had given Gabriel a key to the church. Watched by the commander of the art squad, he engaged the alarm and locked the door. Together they walked to a bar a few doors down from Tintoretto's old house. The papal funeral played on the television behind the counter.
In case you were wondering, said the general, Archbishop Donati wanted you to attend.
And why wasn't I invited?
The Camerlengo wouldn't hear of it.
Albanese?
The general nodded.
Apparently he was never comfortable with the closeness of your relationship with Donati. Or with the Holy Father, for that matter.
It's probably better I'm not there. I would have only been a distraction.
The general frowned.
He should have seated you in a place of honor. After all, were it not for you, the Holy Father would have died in the terrorist attack on the Vatican.
The barman, a skinny 20-something in a black t-shirt, delivered two coffees. The general added sugar to his. The hand that stirred it was missing two fingers. He had lost them to a letter bomb when he was the commander of the Camorra-infested Naples division of the Carabinieri. The explosion had taken his right eye as well. The ocular prosthesis, with its immobile pupil, had left the general with a cold, unyielding gaze. Even Gabriel tended to avoid it. It was like staring into the eye of an all-seeing god. At present, the eye was aimed toward the television, where the camera was panning slowly across a rogues' gallery of politicians, monarchs, and assorted global celebrities. Eventually, it settled on Giuseppe Saviano.
At least he didn't wear his armband, murmured the general.
You're not an admirer?
Saviano is a passionate defender of the art squad's budget. As a result, we get on quite well.
Fascists love cultural patrimony.
He considers himself a populist, not a fascist.
That's a relief. Ferrari's brief smile had no influence over his prosthetic eye.
The rise of a man like Saviano was inevitable. Our people have lost faith with fanciful notions like liberal democracy, the European Union, and the Western Alliance. And why not? Between globalization and automation, most young Italians can't start a proper career. If they want a well-paying job, they have to go to Britain.
And if they stay here? The general glanced at the young man behind the bar.
They serve coffee to tourists.
He lowered his voice.
Or Israeli intelligence officers.
Saviano isn't going to change any of that.
Probably not. But in the meantime, he projects strength and confidence.
How about competence?
As long as he keeps the immigrants out, his supporters don't care if he can't put two words together.
What if there's a crisis? A real crisis, not one that's invented by a right-wing website.
Like what?
It could be another financial crisis that wipes out the banking system. Gabriel paused.
Or something much worse. What could be worse than my life savings going up in smoke?
How about a global pandemic? A novel strain of influenza for which we humans have no natural defense.
A plague?
Don't laugh, Cesare. It's only a matter of time.
And where will this plague of yours come from?
It will make the jump from animals to humans in a place where sanitary conditions leave something to be desired.
The Chinese wet market, for example. It'll start slowly, a cluster of local cases. But because we are so interconnected, it will spread around the globe like wildfire. Chinese tourists will bring it to Western Europe in the early stages of the outbreak, even before the virus has been identified. Within a few weeks, half of Italy's population will be infected, perhaps more.
What happens then, Cesare?
You tell me.
The entire country will have to be quarantined to prevent further spread. Hospitals will be so overwhelmed, they'll be forced to turn away everyone but the youngest and the healthiest. Hundreds will die every day, perhaps thousands. The military will have to resort to mass cremation to prevent further spread. It will be a holocaust. Gabriel nodded slowly. And how do you suppose an incompetent subliterate like Saviano will react under those conditions? Will he listen to medical experts? Or will he think he knows better? Will he tell his people the truth? Or will he promise that a vaccine and life-saving treatments are just around the corner?
He'll blame the Chinese and the immigrants and emerge stronger than ever.
Ferrari looked at Gabriel seriously.
Is there something you know that you're not telling me?
Anyone with half a brain knows we're long overdue for something on the scale of the great influenza of 1918. I've told my prime minister that of all the threats facing Israel, a pandemic is by far the worst.
I'm thankful that my only responsibility is to find stolen paintings.
The general watched as the television camera panned across a sea of red vestments.
There sits the next pontiff.
They say it's going to be Cardinal Navarro.
That's the rumor.
You have any insight? General Ferrari answered as though addressing a room full of reporters.
The Carabinieri make no effort to monitor the papal succession process, nor do the other agencies of Italian security and intelligence.
Spare me.
The general laughed quietly. And what about you? The identity of the next pope is of no concern to the state of Israel.
It is now.
What are you talking about?
I'll let him explain.
General Ferrari nodded toward the television, where the camera had found Archbishop Luigi Donati, private secretary to His Holiness Pope Paul VII.
He was wondering whether you might have a spare moment or two to speak to him.
Why didn't he just call me?
It's not something he wanted to discuss on the phone.
Did he tell you what it was? The general shook his head.
Only that it was a matter of the utmost importance. He was hoping you were free for lunch tomorrow.
Where?
Rome.
Gabriel made no reply.
It's an hour away by plane. You'll be back in Venice in time for dinner.
Will I?
Judging by the Archbishop's tone of voice, I rather doubt it. He's expecting you at 1 o'clock at Piperno. He says you're familiar with it.
It rings a distant bell.
He'd like you to come alone. And don't worry about your wife and children. I'll take very good care of them during your absence.
Absence? It is not the word Gabriel would have chosen to describe a day-long excursion to the Eternal City. The general was staring at the television again.
Look at those princes of the church, all robed in red.
The color symbolizes the blood of Christ. Ferrari's good eye blinked with surprise.
How on earth did you know that?
I've spent the better part of my life restoring Christian art. It's safe to assume I know more about the history and teachings of the church than most Catholics.
Including me.
The general's gaze returned to the screen.
Who do you suppose it will be?
They say Navarro is already ordering new furniture for the appartamento.
Yes, said the general, nodding thoughtfully. That's what they say.
Chapter 4. Murano, Venice.
Please tell me you're joking.
Trust me, it wasn't my idea.
Do you know how much time and effort it took to arrange this trip? I had to meet with the Prime Minister, for heaven's sake.
And for that, said Gabriel solemnly, I am deeply and eternally sorry. They were seated at the back of a small restaurant in Murano. Gabriel had waited until they had finished their entrees before telling Chiara of his plans to travel to Rome in the morning. Admittedly, his motives were selfish. The restaurant, which specialized in fish, was among his favorites in Venice.
It's just one day, Chiara. Even you don't believe that.
No, but it was worth a try.
Chiara raised a wine glass toward her lips. The last of her Pinot Grigio burned with the pale fire of reflected candlelight. Why weren't you invited to the funeral?
Apparently, Cardinal Albanese couldn't find a spare seat for me in the whole of St. Peter's Square.
He was the one who found the body, wasn't he?
In the private chapel, said Gabriel.
Do you really think it happened that way?
Are you suggesting the Vatican press office might have issued an inaccurate bollettino?
You and Luigi collaborated in quite a few misleading statements over the years.
But our motives were always pure.
Chiara placed her wine glass on the bone-white tablecloth and rotated it slowly. Why do you suppose he wants to see you?
It can't be good.
What did General Ferrari say?
As little as possible.
How unlike him.
He might have mentioned that it had something to do with the selection of the next Supreme Pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church. The wine glass went still.
The conclave?
He didn't go into specifics. Gabriel nudged his phone to life and checked the time. He had been forced at long last to part company with his beloved BlackBerry Key 2. His new device was an Israeli-made Solaris, customized to his unique specifications. Larger and heavier than a typical smartphone, it had been built to withstand remote attack from the world's most sophisticated hackers, including the American NSA and Israel's Unit 8200. All of Gabriel's senior officers carried one, as did Chiara. It was her second. Raphael had tossed her first Solaris from the terrace of their apartment in Jerusalem. For all its inviolability, the device had not been designed to survive a fall of 3 floors and a collision with a limestone walkway.
It's late, he said. We should rescue your parents. We don't have to rush. They love having the children around. If it were up to them, we would never leave Venice.
Kingsall Boulevard might notice my absence.
The Prime Minister, too.
She was silent for a moment.
I must admit I'm not looking forward to going home. I've enjoyed having you to myself.
I only have 2 years left on my term.
2 years and 1 month. But who's counting?
Has it been terrible? She made a face.
I never wanted to play the role of the complaining wife. You know the type, don't you, Gabriel? They're so annoying, those women.
We always knew it would be difficult.
Yes, she said vaguely.
If you need help.
Help?
An extra pair of hands around the house. She frowned.
I can manage quite well on my own, thank you. I just miss you, that's all.
2 years will go by in the blink of an eye.
And you promise you won't let them talk you into a second term?
Not a chance.
Her face brightened. So, how do you plan to spend your retirement?
You make it sound as though I should start looking for an assisted living facility.
You are getting on in years, darling. She patted the back of his hand. It didn't make him feel any younger. Well, she asked.
I plan to devote my final years on this earth to making you happy.
So, you'll do anything I want?
He regarded her carefully. Within reason, of course. She cast her eyes downward and picked at a loose thread in the tablecloth.
I had coffee with Francesco yesterday.
He didn't mention it.
I asked him not to.
That explains it. And what did you talk about?
The future.
What does he have in mind?
A partnership.
Francesco and me? Chiara made no reply. You? She nodded.
He wants me to come to work for him. And when he retires in a few years?
What?
Tiepolo Restoration will be mine.
Gabriel recalled the words Tiepolo had spoken while standing over the tomb of Tintoretto. Today you're on holiday, but one day you'll die in Venice. He doubted this scheme had been hatched over coffee yesterday. A nice Jewish girl from the ghetto will be caring for the churches and scuole of Venice? Is that what you're saying?
Rather remarkable, isn't it?
And what will I do?
I suppose you can spend your days wandering the streets of Venice.
Or?
She smiled beautifully. You can work for me.
This time it was Gabriel who looked down. His phone was aglow with an incoming message from Kingsall Boulevard. He turned the device over.
It might be controversial, Chiara. Working for me? leaving Israel the minute my term is over. Do you intend to run for a seat in the Knesset?
He rolled his eyes.
Write a book about your exploits?
I'll leave that chore to someone else.
So?
He made no reply.
If you stay in Israel, you'll be within easy reach of the office. And if there's a crisis, they'll drag you back in to right the ship, just like they did to Ari.
Ari wanted back in. I'm different.
Are you really? Sometimes I'm not so sure about that. In fact, you're getting more like him every day.
What about the children? He asked.
They adore Venice.
School?
Believe it or not, we have several very fine ones.
They'll turn into Italians.
She frowned.
A pity that.
Gabriel exhaled slowly. Have you seen Francesco's books? I'll knock them into shape.
The summers here are dreadful.
We'll go to the mountains or sail the Adriatic. It's been years since you've sailed, darling.
Gabriel had run out of objections.
In truth, he thought it was a marvelous idea. If nothing else, it would keep Chiara occupied during the final 2 years of his term. Do we have a deal? She asked.
I believe we do, provided we come to terms on my compensation package, which will be exorbitant. He signaled the waiter for the check. Chiara was pulling at the loose thread in the tablecloth again.
There's one thing that's bothering me, she said.
About uprooting the children and moving to Venice?
The Vatican Bolettino. Luigi always remained by Lucchese's side late into the evening. And when Lucchese went to the chapel to pray and meditate before bed, Luigi always went with him.
True.
So, why was Cardinal Albanese the one who found the body?
I suppose we'll never know. Gabriel paused. Unless I have lunch with Luigi in Rome tomorrow.
You can go on one condition.
What's that?
Take me with you.
What about the children?
My parents can look after them.
And who's going to look after your parents?
The Carabinieri, of course. But don't make me ask twice, Gabriel. I really hate playing the role of the complaining wife. They're so annoying, those women.
Chapter 5. Venice, Rome. Next morning, they dropped the children at the Zoli house after breakfast and hurried over to Santa Lucia in time to make the 8 o'clock train to Rome. As the rolling plains of central Italy slid past their window, Gabriel read the newspapers and exchanged a few routine emails and texts with Kingsall Boulevard. Chiara leafed through a thick stack of home design magazines and catalogs, licking the tip of her index finger with each turn of the page. Occasionally, when the combination of shadows and light was favorable, Gabriel caught sight of their reflection in the glass. He had to admit, they were an attractive couple. He, in his fashionable dark suit and white dress shirt, Chiara, in her black leggings and leather jacket. Despite the pressure and long hours of his job, and his many injuries and brushes with death, Gabriel judged he had held up rather well. Yes, the lines around his jade-colored eyes were a bit deeper, but he was still trim as a cyclist, and he had retained all his hair. It was short and dark, but very gray at the temples. It had changed color almost overnight, not long after the first assassination he carried out at the behest of the office. The operation had taken place in the autumn of 1972, in the city where they would soon be arriving. As they were approaching Florence, Chiara thrust a catalogue beneath his nose and asked his opinion of the couch and coffee table displayed on the open page. His indifferent response earned him a glance of mild rebuke. It seemed Chiara had already begun scouring the real estate listings for their new home, adding still more evidence to support his theory that a return to Venice had been in the works for some time. For now, she had narrowed her search to two properties, one in Canareggio and a second in San Polo, overlooking the Grand Canal. Both would substantially diminish the small fortune Gabriel had accumulated through his labors as a restorer, and both would require Chiara to commute to Tiepolo's offices in San Marco. The San Polo apartment was much closer, a few stops by Vaporetto. It was also twice the price.
If we sell Narcus Street,
we're not selling it, said Gabriel.
The San Polo apartment has an incredible room with high ceilings where you can build a proper studio.
Which means I can supplement the starvation wages I'll make working for you by taking private commissions.
Exactly.
Gabriel's phone pinged with the tone reserved for urgent messages from Kingsall Boulevard. Chiara watched uneasily as he read it.
Are we going home?
Not yet.
What is it?
A car bombing in the Potsdamer Platz in Berlin.
Casualties?
Probably, but there's no confirmation yet.
Who did it?
The Islamic State is claiming responsibility.
Do they have the capability to carry out a bombing in Western Europe?
If you'd asked me that question yesterday, I would have told you no. Gabriel followed the updates from Berlin until the train pulled into Roma Termini. Outside, the sky was cerulean blue and cloudless. They walked through canyons of terracotta and sienna, keeping to the side streets and alleyways where watchers were easier to spot. While dawdling in the Piazza Navona, they agreed they were not being followed. Ristorante Piperno was a short distance to the south, in a quiet campo near the Tiber. Chiara entered first and was shown by a dazzled white-jacketed waiter to a prized table near the window. Gabriel, who arrived 3 minutes later, sat outside in the warm autumnal sunlight. He could see Chiara's thumbs working furiously over the keypad of her phone. He drew his own device from the breast pocket of his suit jacket and typed, "Something wrong?" Chiara's reply arrived a few seconds later. "Your son just broke my mother's favorite vase." "I'm sure it was the vase's fault, not his. Your lunch date is here." Gabriel watched a worn-out Fiat sedan creeping hesitatingly over the cobbles of the tiny campo. It had ordinary Roman registration, not the special SCV plates reserved for cars from the Vatican. A tall, handsome cleric emerged from the back seat. His black cassock and simar were trimmed in amaranth red, the plumage of an archbishop. His arrival at Ristorante Piperno provoked only slightly less tumult than Chiara's.
"Forgive me," said Luigi Donati, as he sat down opposite Gabriel. "I never should have agreed to speak to that reporter from Vanity Fair. I can't go anywhere in Rome these days without being recognized."
"Why did you do the interview?"
"She made it clear she was going to write the article with or without my cooperation."
"And you fell for it?"
"She promised it would be a serious profile of the man who helped to guide the church through troubled waters. It didn't turn out as promised."
"I assume you're referring to the part about your physical appearance.
Don't tell me you actually read it."
"Every word."
Donati frowned. "I must say the Holy Father rather liked it. He thought it made the church seem cool. His exact word, by the way. My rivals in the Curia didn't agree." He abruptly changed the subject. "I'm sorry about interrupting your holiday. I hope Chiara wasn't angry."
"Quite the opposite."
"Are you telling me the truth?"
"Have I ever misled you?"
"Do you really want me to answer that?" Donati smiled. "It was an effort."
"How are you holding up?" asked Gabriel.
"I'm mourning the loss of my master and adjusting to my reduced circumstances and status loss."
"Where are you staying?"
"The Jesuit Curia. It's just down the street from the Vatican and the Borgo Santo Spirito. My rooms aren't as nice as my apartment in the Apostolic Palace, but they're quite comfortable."
"Have they found something for you to do?"
"I'm going to be teaching canon law at the Gregoriana. I'm also designing a course on the church's troubled history with the Jews." He paused. "Perhaps someday I can convince you to deliver a guest lecture."
"Can you imagine?"
"I can, actually. The relationship between our two faiths has never been better, and it is because of your personal friendship with Pietro Lucchesi."
"I sent you a text the night he died," said Gabriel.
"It meant the world to me."
"Why didn't you respond?"
"For the same reason I didn't challenge Cardinal Albanese when he refused to allow you to attend the funeral. I needed your help on a sensitive matter, and I didn't want to cast any unnecessary light on the closeness of our relationship."
"And the sensitive matter?"
"It concerns the death of the Holy Father. There were certain irregularities,
beginning with the identity of the person who discovered the body."
"You noticed that?"
"Actually, it was Chiara."
"She's a smart woman."
"Why did Cardinal Albanese find the body? Why wasn't it you, Luigi?"
Donati looked down at his menu. "Perhaps we should order something to start. How about the fried artichoke leaves and zucchini flowers? And the filetti di bacalà? The Holy Father always swore they were the best in Rome."
Chapter 6. Ristorante Piperno, Rome. The maitre d' insisted on sending over a bottle of complimentary wine. It was something special, he promised, a fine white from a small producer in Abruzzo. He was certain His Excellency would find it more than satisfactory. Donati, with considerable ceremony, declared it divine. Then, when they were alone again, he described for Gabriel the final hours of the papacy of Pope Paul VII. The Holy Father and his private secretary had shared a meal, a last supper, said Donati gravely, in the dining room of the papal apartments. Donati had taken only a bit of consommé. Afterward, the two men had adjourned to the study where Donati, at the Holy Father's request, had opened the curtains and the shutters of the window overlooking St. Peter's Square. It was the penultimate act of service he would perform for his master, at least while His Holiness was still alive. And the final act? Asked Gabriel. I laid out the Holy Father's nightly dose of medication. What was he taking? Donati recited the names of three prescription drugs, all for the treatment of a failing heart. You managed to conceal it quite well, said Gabriel. We're rather good at that around here. I seem to recall